The Guardian.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. On this week's podcast, well, actually, it is rocket science. We take a tour around a facility in Los Angeles, owned by a man who wants to retire to Mars.
South Korea's tried a couple times and they failed. This is normally like a country thing, and only a few countries have succeeded. People just like said there's no chance, no, you forget it, I mean, the guy's crazy. But I think then when we got to orbit, people were like, whoa, okay, it actually did work.
We speak to Elon Musk, the rich engineer who inspired that rich entrepreneur in the Iron Man movies.
We want to do deep space propulsion, ion drives, that kind of thing. Some people are kind of doing it in their spare time. But, you know, an ion drive is definitely something it's useful to have for interplanetary travel.
Why bacteria is the new black? We try on the clothes of the future.
She actually grows tubs of bacterial cellulose at home in vats, which is basically a fermented green tea solution. And then she molds them into clothes.
Plus, my attempt to upset an emotional robot.
That was anger. That was fear.
And some important information if you're planning a holiday to a nudist camp.
That was excitement.
This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. And hello to all our new listeners to this podcast. Let's start this week with someone who Esquire magazine named one of the 75 most influential people of the 21st century. He's also listed in Time magazine's 100 people who most affect the world. He co-founded PayPal, a company he later sold for a tidy sum to eBay, so he's very rich indeed. Jealous yet? The billionaire is engaged to a movie star. British actress Tallulah Riley starred in St. Trinian's films. By the way, he's only 39 and he used to fly his own private military fighter jet in whatever spare time he had. Jealous now? Oh yeah, and he builds space rockets which one day could take people to Mars. Entrepreneur and philanthropist, Elon Musk is the CEO and CTO of SpaceX, CEO of Tesla Motors and chairman of SolarCity. SpaceX's first rocket, Falcon 1, put a satellite into orbit. The company's much bigger Falcon 9 also successfully launched earlier this year. Elon is also the inspiration for the Tony Stark character in the Iron Man movies. And now, after all that, he's made it onto this podcast. The Observer's Paul Harris went to meet Elon at his factory in Los Angeles. He began by talking about the moment his dream of reaching the stars became a reality.
When we launched the initial rocket, it was like, holy crap, that thing's actually leaving the launch pad. That was awesome. Getting to orbit is when a lot of people finally concluded, okay, it's real. Because getting to orbit, I mean, that's something that, say, you know, South Korea's tried a couple times and they failed. Brazil's tried three times and they failed. So like this is normally like a country thing and only a few countries have succeeded. So getting to orbit, I mean, people just like said there's no chance, no, you forget it, I mean, the guy's crazy. But I think then when we got to orbit, people were like, whoa, okay, it actually did work. And then with the second flight where we delivered our first satellite, that was, you know, that got a little more people believing. And then Falcon 9, which is a much bigger vehicle. Because when we got Falcon 1 to orbit, they said, oh sure, you can put like a little rocket to orbit. You know, it's only, you know, that rocket's only, it's basically the size of equivalent of a corporate jet. You know, it's like, sure, you can build a, you know, a Gulfstream, but you can build like an airliner, you know. And then Falcon 9, which has got four times the thrust of a 747, weighs about as much as a 747 on liftoff. When that got to orbit, now people are like, okay, that's big time. When I was in college, there were three areas that I thought would most affect the future of humanity. Those were the internet, transitioning to a sustainable energy economy, and the third was space exploration, and ultimately extending life beyond Earth and making it multiplanetary. So with the capital that I gained from the internet activity, I was able to take action in the sustainable energy and in space exploration.
And is it really, you know, it is that level of sort of high vision where you're sort of seeing that sort of ultimate goal of humanity's mission, not just one company or one man's mission?
Right, I just think it's important that we attempt to extend life beyond Earth now. It's the first time in the 4 billion year history of Earth that it's been possible. And
that window could be open for a long time. Hopefully it is. Or it could be open for a short time. But I think we should err on the side of caution and do something now.
And I'm not saying it should be everyone's sort of top priority or anything. Yeah. But I think it should be something that we, you know, collectively humanity should assign some priority to. Maybe it's, you know, somewhere in between healthcare and cosmetics. The two general areas why I think this is important, but I mean, the one that we've touched on already is that it's sort of a preservation of life argument, and not just humanity, but life as we know it, which could get wiped out. Certainly will at some point as the sun expands, but it could get wiped out far sooner than that. There's another angle which I personally find more appealing, which is the inspiration angle. Life on Earth must be about more than just solving problems.
Yeah.
You know, if all we do all day is just we solve problems, and it's, why get up in the morning?
Yeah.
You know, there's got to be something inspiring. There's got to be, even if it's vicarious, as it was when although the United States landed on the moon, really that was for all humanity. I mean, I think we count that as a human achievement of great significance.
Yeah.
Anyone who could get near a TV got near a TV.
Yeah.
You know, it's if there was one TV in an African village, yet to walk 50 miles to go there, they'd do it, you know. But those are the two big ones, and I think it's so therefore deserving of some moderate amount of resources, maybe, I don't know, 0.5% of the economy or something like that, which I think would be enough and good for all humanity.
How did you feel when Falcon 9 was successful?
I was definitely very happy.
Is that an understatement?
Yeah. No, I was quite elated, I'd say. You know, which is different from the, when we first got to orbit with Falcon 1.
Yeah.
It was, I felt relief, not elation. Just thank goodness we're not going to die, type of thing.
Yeah.
SpaceX, I mean. Yeah. And I must have felt great, but actually I just felt like, you know, if you've been carrying this giant backpack of lead around with you and suddenly someone took it off, yeah, you feel relieved.
What's the next big milestone?
Well, it depends on how big is big. There's the launch of our Dragon spacecraft. That's our upcoming launch. It's
do you have a date for that yet?
Probably late September-ish. You know, it's difficult to predict the exact launch date because it depends on when we finish development of Dragon. It's 99% done, but there's still a little bit left. So figure September, give or take a few months.
Yeah. Do you have a vision beyond the Dragon?
Yeah, sure. Well, there's our Falcon 9 Heavy, which will be the most capable vehicle in the world since the Saturn V. Carry more payload to orbit than any other vehicle.
Yeah.
That's probably about 2.5 years away, thereabouts. And then we want to do deep space propulsion, ion drives, that kind of thing.
Is that sort of stuff that's just on the whiteboard at the moment?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Some people are kind of doing it in their spare time.
Yeah.
But you know, an ion drive is definitely something it's useful to have for interplanetary travel.
How do you react to the whole Iron Man comparison?
Well, I think there's some similarities. I think also some significant differences. I think probably the biggest similarity is that I'm the chief designer and the CEO, which is unusual. Yeah, I'm involved in sort of a lot of advanced technology and whatnot, but I also have kids and I have 5 kids.
Yeah.
You know, Iron Man doesn't have any kids. It's kind of cool, I suppose. One of the long-term goals of SpaceX is really to enable almost anyone to go to space.
Yeah.
And ultimately to get the cost of transporting people and cargo to Mars to be low enough and reliable and with a high enough reliability that if somebody wanted to sell all their belongings and move to a new planet and help forge a new civilization, they could do so. That's really the long-term goal.
What sort of length How long is long term?
Well, hopefully less than 20 years.
Really, that quickly?
Well, 20 years seems like semi-infinity to me.
What do your kids think?
They're not that impressed, I think. I mean, they're only six, and right. Six and three, so... I think they'll have a much better sense for it in a few years. They're hard to impress. I mean, at least maybe they're impressed, but they're just not impressed around me. They have no idea about PayPal or anything. I mean, they know about toys. I mean, Tula and I took them to the UK last month after a few days and took them to Hamleys. And we bought a bunch of toys. And then one of the kids said, asked me if I'd still have any money left after we bought all these toys. It's like, yep. Toys aren't that expensive in the grand scheme of things.
Elon Musk talking about big and small toys at his factory in LA. There's a video on our website where you can see inside Elon's factory, where, by the way, part of Iron Man 2 was actually filmed. And you can see some of his rockets blast off too. That's at guardian.co.uk/video. If you follow this podcast on Twitter, look for @ScienceWeekly. We'll let you know every time a new podcast is launched. And for the rest of the Guardian Science content, go to @GuardianScience.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk with Alok Jha.
Let's now have a look at some of the other stories around this week.
News Jack.
Details of a food scare in the UK continue to emerge. The Food Standards Agency has admitted it doesn't know how many embryos from cloned animals have been imported into Britain. It's after it was revealed meat from a clone had already entered the food chain and been eaten.
Some numbers have finally been attached to the phrase, "there are many more fish in the sea." The first global census of marine life has logged 230,000 species. The 10-year study by 360 scientists has identified which parts of the world's oceans are teeming with life and which parts are becoming barren. They also warn that there could be mass extinctions as the world's environment changes in the decades to come.
The latest study on heart disease has found that a host of genetic factors predispose people to attacks. It's the most common killer in Britain and elsewhere in the developed world. The research has uncovered clues to preventing the condition and paves the way for a test to predict the risk.
And let's finish on a story for beach bums, as bottoms bring up the rear in suntan time trials. A study shows some body parts are more sensitive to the sun's damaging effects than others. Naturists will struggle to get that perfect all-over tan, as the buttocks take a lot longer to go brown than other parts of their anatomy. Previous research shows the upper back is much more likely to tan than the legs, and that the outsides of the arms go brown far quicker than the insides. The findings show most advice about how long it's safe to spend in the sun is worthless, because different body parts are more sensitive to the sun's damaging effects than others.
To discuss some of those stories, we've got The Observer's Robin McKee and The Guardian's Nell Bowes and Ian Sample. Robin, let's start with the cloned meat story. How did this meat get into the food chain?
The issue is here whether, in fact, this is a novel food or not. The meat from a cloned, the offspring of a cloned cow, and the FSA, Food Standards Agency, seems to think that it is a novel food and therefore should be governed by regulations. But the European Commission says that the FSA is talking through a hole in its what's it, and so we don't, you know, we're left in this kind of limbo at the moment about, is this a novel food? Is it dangerous? A lot of papers have made a great deal of it. Frankly, you know, it's perfectly safe.
It's a cloned cow is genetically identical to the parent or where that it came from. Ian, what's the problem potentially that anyone might have with it?
The real problem is simply public reaction, and it's pretty much like the old days of GM, whereas saying anything is genetically modified sent certain people running for the hills, saying, "Oh my God, scientists are being Frankenstein." Exactly the same thing is happening with the idea of cloned meat. People think, oh no, it's these aren't even cloned animals, these are offspring of cloned animals, and they're saying, oh no, it must be, people think there must be something negative about that, there must be something wrong about that. Think about why this is done. The embryos are taken cloned embryos are produced from cows which are either like producing superior meat or superior milk, you know, at great yields or what have you. And that's why farmers want cloned animals, you know, so they can have high yield animals. Now, there's no reason why the milk or the meat would be substantially any different, because it's a clone. I mean, why would it be any different? Now, there is an issue that we should definitely raise, and that is one of a potential issue of animal welfare. If you think back to Dolly the sheep, she lived 6 and a half years. Normally a sheep would live to 11 or 12, and she died with a lung disease that normally comes on in much older age. She also had premature arthritis. And this can be an issue with cloned animals, is that the animal doesn't develop as well as a naturally born animal. And so you can end up with the animal just being a bit sick. Now, if that can somehow impacts on its milk quality or its beef, then that is something to look at. But there is no sort of general reason why there should be a problem.
I mean, this is market forces. But if these will determine this. If these are animals that are not producing the yields that are expected, they won't be used. And now, clearly they have been used because they are producing the yields and the quality that are expected of them.
Now, would you eat a cloned burger?
Yeah, I don't think I'd have any problem with it. I mean, I'd take what you mean about the example of Dolly. What's interesting is that there's, when you hear discussion about this, you know, I've listened to the Today programme, and there was a kind of, was an underlying assumption that there probably is some kind of problem with cloning, which is, seems to be an odd default position. I mean, obviously, you know, have a look at it, highlight the risk and things, but it seems an extremely strong precautionary principle given the nature of what we're actually discussing.
I think it just shows how immediately negative the reaction of and I don't know if it is the public, actually. It might just be the media. It might be the media just thinking, oh, cloned, you know, and just assuming that people will not like it. And therefore, the supermarkets say, we don't want cloned stuff, we're not going to sell it. And then the milk producers say, a milk company has already asked all of its dairy producers to sign forms asserting that none of its milk comes from cloned animals. But you have to think about, if you saw a cow that just wasn't in great shape, okay, it was just a bit sickly, you wouldn't immediately think, I bet if I eat the meat from that cow, it will be toxic to me, it will be dangerous for me, and equal the milk. Maybe if an animal is sick in some way, it might affect it. I mean, it may affect its muscle composition in some sense. If it had a muscle-wasting genetic condition, it may affect it, the composition of its milk. But this is actually going one step further and saying, you know, that these changes must make it dangerous to health. I mean, by what mechanism? I mean, meat would have to be kind of infected with prions or moldy or, you know, you have to go quite a long way to make something dangerous to you.
I think perhaps also it's worth pointing out that, especially in the UK, perhaps anything to do with cows, dairy herds, has that sort of element of scare because of BSE from the 80s.
Yeah,
and the disaster that the government made of persuading people that this was not an issue. Well, trying to persuade them it wasn't an issue.
Well, the moment you ask me, would you eat cloned meat? I have a vision of John Gummer with the burger feeding his daughter, which obviously haunts any scientist talking about
these
matters.
She's still alive, isn't she? Yeah. Also worth pointing out, agriculture does much more to change animals than cloning has in any part of history. Plus, also, apparently all strawberries are clones. So there you go. There you are.
And they're easier to push
and bananas.
Over.
Nice. All right, let's move on to fish. Do any of you know how many fish there are in the sea or other creatures? Anyone?
Why doesn't someone ask me? 230,000 species.
Why doesn't someone ask me this question?
How many species of fish are there in the oceans?
Well, it turns out, actually, Robin, there's something like
17,000
identified species. But there could be, that's only about 60 to 70%. There's going to be another 40% discovered. And they identified the areas of the world which have the best biodiversity in the oceans. These include anywhere in the Southeast Asian waters, around Australia as well. And the places where, you know, they're thinking there's a lot of threats, so the Mediterranean, the Gulf of Mexico, the Baltic Sea, the Caribbean. These places are what they call enclosed seas, where if you throw chemicals or stuff in there, it's going to not go away as quickly as it does in the open ocean. So therefore, the wildlife there is most at risk. And very interesting stuff. Any questions?
I have absolutely a question.
Go on.
You, I don't know how you thought you'd get away with this,
what?
But in the introduction to that, you said that another 40% will be found. You said they found 17,000 species. Yeah. Another 40% will be found. So I reckon that makes it something like 24,000.
That's right.
Species. How do they know? That doesn't sound very objective science.
No, no.
How do they know how many they are yet to find?
It's interesting. It's a process called rarefaction. What they do, they can estimate the number of species out there. And for example, say you have a garden pond and you do a survey of this garden pond. You get a certain number of species of something or whatever's in there. Then you do another one a few months later. And you'll mostly get the same species as you got last time, but you might get a few more. And you keep doing this until essentially you don't get any more. And you can then work out from that what you're missing from different areas of the world. And they can estimate.
Kind of your sampling error.
Yeah, they can estimate what there is left to find. Most of these species might never be found, by the way, because climate change, acidification of the oceans is killing things very quickly. And so what they were quite shocked by is that some parts of the world, even around the season, Australia, Antarctica, most of the species they reckon they haven't found yet. And that these are the places with the most biodiversity.
That's very good, Alec, but remember, nobody likes a smart Alec.
I'm just saying, if I'm asked a question, I'm going to answer it.
Do they have any recommendations on how to, on areas that we should be focusing on in terms of conservation or in terms of...
Yeah, well, I mean, so the five places they mentioned as most at risk: Mediterranean, Gulf of Mexico, the China's shelves.
Is the Gulf of Mexico literally just in the last few
months?
Well,
no, I think it's been before as well, but they did say actually that they happened to have surveyed the entire Gulf of Mexico last year before the oil spill. So they're now going to go back and look what's happened. So also, it's interesting to point out that this census is going to be a baseline figure for the future. So we're going to be able to see now how climate change affects these places. And it's going to devastate lots of populations in some of these places, obviously. Interestingly, for example, in the Mediterranean, the problem is because it's an enclosed sea, anything you dump in there doesn't get released so quickly. And they found all sorts of species with chemicals from warheads from the Kosovo War, the munitions damage, all sorts of stuff, litter from cruises. Lots of people are sort of cruising across the Mediterranean, just dumping stuff overboard. This is killing the wildlife there, which is depressing. For more on all this stuff, go to guardian.co.uk/science or environmentguardian.co.uk. Fictional robots always have a personality. Marvin was paranoid, C-3PO was fussy, and HAL 9000 was just murderous. But reality is a bit different. Sophisticated enough to assemble cars or assist during complex surgery, modern robots are usually just dumb automatons. That could soon change, though. At the University of Hertfordshire's robotics lab, Lola Canyamero has been working on the world's first robot that can develop emotions. Called Now, it can learn to interact with people and respond with one of six emotions, including happiness, sadness, and anger. I went to meet Now last week.
I am going to show you six emotional poses. Can you guess what I am trying to express? That was anger. That was fear. That was sadness. That was happiness. That was excitement. That was pride. So, how many did you guess?
So we're at the robotics lab in the University of Hertfordshire with Now. This is one of the first robots in the world that can develop emotions, and I'm going to see how emotional it can get. So at the moment, it's completely neutral. So let's see what we can do if I have a look at it. Hello. I'm going to try and make it scared. I've been told that making it scared means hitting it on its head. There we go. Oh, no, there it goes. It's scared. No, don't be scared. If I stroke its head, maybe? Does it get happier then? No? Oh no, you're getting out. Look, it's moving its arms out. No, it's... What's this? This is some other new emotion I've not experienced at all, in fact. Can I make you happy somehow? There we go. How happy is that? It's a very happy robot.
Goodbye, Guardians readers.
You can watch a video of our emotionally charged encounter at guardian.co.uk/science. There's a link to that on our blog, guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly, where you can also subscribe to this podcast.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk.
The fashion industry is turning to science to find ways of reducing waste. Will it ever be possible to grow our own underpants, which we could later eat? Should we be able to order shirts that fit our exact body shape? How can the latest research into polymer materials help? So many questions. For the answers, we went along to the Trash Fashion exhibition at the London Science Museum.
And then little by little by little, the bacteria is going to grow and is going to create this bacteria cellulose.
Hello, I'm Nelly Benayoun and I'm working with Suzanne Lee. And Suzanne is a designer who started a project in 2004 called Bio Couture, which basically started as how can you grow a dress from a vat of liquid. And the question was, is that possible? And yes, it is. So here we've got the kombucha culture. Kombucha liquid, so you've got green tea, sugar, and here is a mother culture, which is basically the mummy of all the bacteria that we are using in there. But anyway, so you put that in there, do not touch it, cover it with a lid, let it like that, and then little by little, that will grow this sheet of bacterial cellulose. And basically, cellulose is like paper. But in that specific case, what is quite amazing about the material is that you can eat it. I could make it fried in olive oil. I could eat the whole material. So I could basically eat my dress. But we are not in such a scenario quite yet, but maybe soon. So then I just put it in there, and I add a bit of cold water. Here we go. And then I just use a piece of wood. So in that case, I've got a ball, but it could be, you know, something completely flattened. So I end up with something flat. But then if I take something you already have a 3D shape, then it will dry and it will take the shape of that ball. So then I put it in there, I let it drain, and you will end up with that sort of material, which is like leather. Basically, that's a really handmade or DIY way of doing it. But right now, we are actually setting up this collaboration with Imperial College. So what we can get out of there is actually making it of this material something which doesn't smell. Because so far, I really smell tea. I really smell, you know, it goes through a fermentation process. So you don't really want to have a dress with smell. But also, we are thinking about new application of it. You know, this is something that you can eat. So potentially, I could grow a table, right? And I could eat that table. Or you can actually, you know, if you think within an architecture context, this material is completely fully sustainable. I could engineer the bacteria, so then the material I've got at the end is something which will die in 1 year if I use it for a plastic bag, or would die in, you know, 1 week. I could use it for space industry, so then it could stay forever. It can be actually really dead strong. You know, you can actually really open up the potential application of it.
We can give you like a printout of different sizes.
Well, it's a 3D body scanner based on white light technology. My name is Richard Allen. I'm Director of Shape Analysis Limited. What it does, it takes a surface scan of the body using 16 different sensors, 32 different cameras, and you get a full sort of 3D body image. And the actual technology is called stereophotogrammetry. So it works basically where the eyes work. You sort of see it through two different points, and then you can range find to a straight point. It works as stereophotogrammetry and structured light techniques. You've got a stripe pattern projected onto the body, and you're viewing it through different cameras, through two different angles. Where those pixels locate to each other on each individual image, you can then create a 3D image from that. You get 16 different sort of parts of the body all the way around. Those are then put together to make a whole body scan. And from there, you can then create a body model, which is a smooth, segmented body. So you can know where the arms are, you know where the legs are. And then you can then extract accurate measurements from there. On a human, it's about plus or minus 3 millimetres. And on a static object, plus or minus 1 millimetre. Problem is we tend to move, you see, a bit. So there's many applications. I mean, we started quite a few years ago, in the year 2000, using one of these body scanners to measure the whole size and shape of the UK population. So we measured 10,000 people, 5,000 men, 5,000 women. It was done with 19 retailers. And their aim was to be able to find out what the size and shape of the population was. The last survey had been done in 1951, and that was done with tape measures and calipers. It's a very, very slow process. And they wanted updated information because we're obviously changing. We've all grown taller, all got a bit slightly larger around the girth. And, you know, they needed to be able to make clothes that fit the population of today. That's the first thing. Second thing is customised clothing. We can use this to actually take a single body scan of an individual, take accurate measurements from that body scan, and then produce clothing to fit that person correctly. We're doing sort of virtual fashion, where you can scan somebody, and then you can actually select what type of clothes in the store, you know, the type of top or, you know, trousers or whatever, put them on the body, and then actually see what you really do look like in 3D, and actually rotate the body around and see what you really do look like.
I'm Alexander Bismarck, professor on polymer materials at Imperial College London. We in chemical engineering are interested in polymer materials, especially for applications in harsh environments. This could be polymer composites, porous polymers, or water-soluble polymers. The main focus in our case is challenging environments like the oil industry, materials that can be used down in oil well, for instance, to cement casings into place, polymers that you pump down an oil well to reduce drag and therefore create larger fractures in hydraulic fracturing, polymers that will degrade after itself, so you save water in cleanup treatments. Polymers are composites, for instance, that store electrical energy and could power mobile devices. We're working also on liquid formulations that you pump in place, say in an oil well, to create a filter down well. You flip a switch, it turns into a solid material, highly permeable, very strong, and removes fines that otherwise would be very damaging to upstream equipment.
You can check out the results of a full body scan and see what clothes grown from green tea look like. There's a video at guardian.co.uk/video. You can also join our Facebook group. We've handily called ourselves the Guardian Science Weekly Podcast, where you can chat with other listeners and post comments on the wall. We'll also let you know every Monday when a new podcast is uploaded. That's it for this show. Thanks to Elon Musk, Paul Harris, Ian Sample, Robin McKee and Nell Bowes. Next week, why ants can make us better at communicating and decision-making. Plus, we go on a behind-the-scenes tour of a multi-million pound redevelopment of one of Britain's best science museums. Don't forget to add your voice to our debate at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. This podcast was produced by Andy Duckworth. I'm Alok Jha. Thanks for listening. Is it possible to grow our own underpants? Sorry. Okay. Is it possible to grow... Is it possible to grow our own underpants, which we can later eat? Should we? Oh dear! Will it ever be possible to grow?
And let's finish on a story for beach bums as bottoms bring up the rear in suntan time trials. I'm just making myself laugh. I've suddenly become all seaside postcard.
Relax. People spend 10 minutes training their voices and to get ready for this sort of thing, and I'm launching straight in, you're complaining.
Have you got both feet?
Okay.
Put that on the end of the podcast, you know.
Right, good.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.